We turn to Genesis chapter 11. Now, Genesis chapter 10 introduced us to this character, Nimrod, who was the son of Cush. In chapter 10, verse 8, we read that Nimrod, whose name means rebel, he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, and the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. And this man, Nimrod, who is one of the ancient great ones, appears to have been an instigator of widespread apostasy from the faith and worship of God. He is almost certainly the one who organized and encouraged the building of the Tower of Babel in his own kingdom. And Dr. Robert Candlish, in his commentary, tells us that at Babel was the first open avowal of idolatry. So we're not to think of him just as a hero in the distant past, reckoned so by many, but as possibly the first who introduced idolatry into the world. And somehow it's connected with what follows in chapter 11. The building of the Tower of Babel. At the close of our study last time, I gave you some reasons why we should consider this tower to have some kind of religious significance. Let me remind you of some of the truths which prove that and add some others. The first is that the name Nimrod gave to this place suggests that he was an idolater. It was the name Babel. And Babel comes from a root which originally meant the gate of God. The gate of God. And that indicates, I think, that there was something religious and something which concerned worship in this particular place. Then secondly, we observe that the tower was built that it may reach to heaven in verse 4. That it may reach to heaven. And we notice that the words may reach are in italics. And therefore the verb is to be supplied. And it may well be that the real import of these words is the tower, the top of the tower, was unto heaven as a temple was dedicated to heaven. And therefore the purpose behind the building of the tower was to adore the things of heaven and probably the heavenly host. The third remark I'd make is that this would then be the time when the worship of God was corrupted to the worship of things. And Paul alludes to this in Romans 1:21. And he says, speaking of the Gentile world, when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the uncorruptible God into an image made like to corruptible man. Romans 1:21 and 23. Now at a certain period of history, there was worship offered, which was offered to the creature, and marked the beginning of the decline and the departure so characteristic of the heathen world. And it is suggested with a great degree of probability that that's what we have here. The fourth remark is this, that such staged temple towers, or ziggurats, as they were called, ZIGGURATS, were quite common in ancient Babylonia. The towers, or these ziggurats, were often of tremendous size. They went up in the form of a pyramid. Each stage of the building being slightly smaller than the base, slightly smaller than the one that preceded. So it proceeded from a wide base upward to a much more narrower room, which usually was a shrine to some deity, to some idol god. Now, we know that a king called Esarhaddon in 681, well, between 681 and 665 BC, restored one of these at Babylon. And it was called the building whose top is in heaven. Very similar to wording to what we have here. That restored ziggurat was later destroyed, I think, by Xerxes, and then it was rebuilt again and so on throughout history. But it was discovered as late as 1899 by a man called Kaldui. And this was one of the earliest to which we have reference. But its archaeologists have revealed that there are a number of such towers known in ancient Babylonia. Now, what's particularly interesting with reference to that is that we're told here of what they made it of. They made brick for stone, verse 3, and slime had they for mortar, asphalt, as a kind of cement. And we now know that one of the great temples of ancient Babylon, the temple of Belus, B-E-L-U-S, was formed of exactly those materials. It is hard to see why a tower, obviously of tremendous magnitude, was made, unless there was this religious significance, unless it was for some purpose of worship. Now, the early Jewish commentators suggest that this was indeed the case. The Jerusalem Targum, which represents Jewish tradition going back hundreds of years, says of Nimrod, "He was a hunter of the children of men in their languages, and he said unto them, Depart from the religion of Shem, and cleave unto the institutes of Nimrod." And so the Jews understood it to be the first outbreak of fearful idolatry. The sixth remark is that it is clear that the old Babylon was associated with the most terrible forms of idolatry, and from the earliest times. Now, I gave you a reference last time, I think, from Jeremiah 50, where Babylon is actually called the city or the place of idols. And it says in verse 8 of Jeremiah 50, "They are mad upon their idols." We'll find the same kind of reference, however, in chapter 51 of Jeremiah, and 47 and following, where God says through Jeremiah, I will do judgment upon the graven images of Babylon, and her whole land shall be confounded. Well, that is confirming that it was a center of idolatrous practice. But the seventh observation I would make is that what took place in this land and in this city of Babylon in particular finds a parallel in apostate Christendom. And I say that on account of the reference in Revelation 17 and verse 5, which describes the fallen church. And it says in verse 4, the woman, that is the symbol of the church, was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication, and upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Now why call a fallen idolatrous church Mystery Babylon? Unless it is for the reason that she is the culmination of all that was Babylonian. And the ancient idolatry of Babylon finds fullest expression in her. I think the evidence, therefore, accumulates, and I think at the end it's overwhelming and explains the divine reaction, which was so severe and so powerful, that what took place was the introduction of a gross form of idolatry. Now, that gives us a greater understanding of the chapter, because in the first 9 verses of the chapter, there is the description of this false religion. And then from verse 10 to verse 32, there is the progress of true religion and God's purpose concerning the true religion, which will come through Abraham and through the children of Israel and ultimately through Christ. Now, because I have left to me tonight the second part of the chapter, which is from verse 10 to verse 32, which is not exactly a fertile ground for any preacher, I want to look at the first part and the second part together in the light of what I've said. If we look at those first 9 verses, the building of the Tower of Babel, let's put it under the heading of false religion. And let us observe at once that there are remarkable parallels between the worship of ancient Babylon and the worship of modern Babylon as seen in the fallen and apostate Church of Rome, described there in Revelation 17. Now, the early church fathers saw a very real connection between Babylon and Rome. Papias, who was a disciple of John the Apostle, tells us Babylon was Rome. Tertullian, writing at the end of the second century, says, in the writings of St. John, Babylon is a figure of the Roman city. Jerome, who comes in the 4th century, the Roman city is spiritually called Babylon. And Augustine in the 5th century, the greatest perhaps of the church fathers, says Rome is the second Babylon. Now at that period in church history, these early church fathers had no knowledge or experience of the Church of Rome as such, but they were led in their studies to see that there was a parallel between Babylon and Rome. And after the age of these fathers, the Church of Rome, or towards the end of the age of the fathers, I should say more accurately, the Church of Rome came into great prominence. And she began to assume certain powers, and she began to change the teachings of Christ and the apostles. And what took place was very strange indeed, because not the city of Rome, but the Church of Rome became increasingly as old Babylon was. And the prophecy of Revelation was therefore beginning to be understood, and it was far more perfectly understood by the reformers, of course, in the 15th and 16th centuries, because they saw that the parallel to be drawn was not so much between the city of Babylon and the city of Rome, that far the early church fathers had reached, but really between the city of Babylon and the Church of Rome. And therefore, in the book of Revelation, we are not only introduced to the true church as the bride's, the Lamb's wife, in clean garments prepared for her husband, chaste, righteous, and so on, but we are introduced to this fallen woman, this figure of a fallen woman, a whore, or a prostitute, a woman who's debased herself. Not therefore the true church, but the fallen church, full of idolatry, full of corruption. And John calls this fallen woman, contrasted with the bride of Christ, he calls her Mystery Babylon. Now, friends, the more we look into these things, the more intriguing it all becomes. And let me give you some interesting facts which connect the worship of the ancient Babylonians with the worship of modern Romanists. The first fact is this, and all these things can be verified and proved by various historical writings and texts. The first thing is this: an essential part of the old Babylonian system of worship was the worship of the sun, or Baal, as the one true God. And there are references in Scripture to that worship of the sun god. And therefore, in the cult of Babylon, there was great emphasis upon light. And what do we find? Well, let me give you just one example here from the prophecy of Ezekiel in chapter 8 and verse 16. And Ezekiel is describing idolatrous worshippers of his day. Remember, he's living in Babylon during this time of captivity. And he says that there were worshippers. This is Ezekiel 8:16. Between the porch and the altar were about 25 men, with their backs toward the temple of the Lord, and their faces toward the east. And they worshipped the sun toward the east. So was it in Babylonish worship. And yet there is tremendous emphasis in its counterpart today in the Roman Communion on worshipping towards the east. In fact, church buildings are constructed to allow the worship to be directed to the east. In the same connection, there was also a great use of wax candles and lights. Even as today, if you go into a Roman Catholic building, you'll often find it very dark and dismal. The darkness only penetrated by the lights, sometimes of numerous candles, in certain places in the building. Have you noticed too that in the pictures of Roman Catholic saints, invariably there is representation of the saint with a halo? Appears to be a sun around the head. Such representations are to be found in Babylon. The worship of the sun god. The second connecting point is this. A mother and child were worshipped in ancient Babylon. And archaeology has proven this time and again, because monuments have been dug up which show the goddess mother, Semiramis, with her child, Tammuz, in her arms. The worship of the mother and child. Yet when we study modern Roman worship, the Madonna and the child feature very large indeed. This did not originate in the Church of Rome. It originated in the idolatry of Babylon. A third fact which should be considered is this, that the goddess queen, the mother in these statues, differed from the sun which she was carrying in her arms. The goddess was always represented as kind and gentle. And she bore a particular name in the Babylonish religion, Milita, M-Y-L-I-T-T-A, which means mediatrix or mediator. The counterpart is in the Church of Rome. That Mary, whom Rome honours with a degree of honour equivalent to worship, is always represented as benign and gentle. And it's the teaching of the Roman Church that if the penitent feels he cannot go to the Redeemer, the Son, then he should avail himself of the possibility of going to Mary in prayer. Hence the prayers of the Rosary, addressed to Mary, the kind, the sympathetic one, the lovingly succouring one. And Mary in the Church of Rome has been formally given this title of mediatrix, a go-between the worshipper and God. The fourth fact is this, that the high priest in ancient Babylon was called Pontifex Maximus. And that title was bequeathed from a king of Babylon to Julius Caesar in BC 63. And it was used by the Roman emperors until the year 375. When the Emperor Gratian renounced it as a title, and almost at once it was assumed by the Bishop of Rome, Pontifex Maximus, Supreme Pontiff. Such a high priest was known in the worship of Babylon, and amazingly is known in the worship of modern Romanism. The fifth fact is that the symbol of sacerdotal claims in ancient Babylon was a headpiece. This headpiece was associated in the polytheistic religion of Babylon with the Baal of the sea. It appeared to be fish-like. If you look at the figures we have of this, or representations of this particular headwear worn by the hierarchical members of the cult of Babylon, you will see it to be identical with what we know as a mitre. Two sides representing the top and the bottom of a fish's mouth opened. The sixth fact is that the ancient Babylonians had a belief in new life through the passing through of water. In their initiatory ceremony, by which a person became a member of the cult, water came into contact with the person's body, and Tertullian, describing this heathen rite, says, regeneration and pardon of all perjuries came thereby. The identical doctrine is in the Church of Rome today. It's known as baptismal regeneration. Through the application of water, a child is given new life and is made a member of the church and an inheritor of the kingdom of heaven. The seventh fact is this. There was in the Babylonish religion the idea of an unbloody sacrifice. The authorities tell us that on the great altars of Babylon, there was no sacrifice of blood. They were bloodless altars. The Church of Rome, even to this day, speaks of the unbloody sacrifice of the Eucharist and of the Holy Mass. And the sacrifice which is offered time and again upon Roman Catholic altars is unbloody. The eighth fact, and this may come as a surprise to you, but the symbol of the cross was used in Babylon. It's known as the mysterious Tau, T-A-U, of the ancient Chaldeans. And the origin of it is that it was the first letter of the god worshipped in Babylon, or one of the gods worshipped, which was Tammuz, to which we had that reference earlier in the book of Ezekiel. And so the figure of a cross, or a crude T, was to be found upon the high priest's vestments and upon the priest's clothing and even upon their buildings. Church of Rome makes a great deal of the wooden cross. You go into any Roman Catholic church and you'll be confronted somewhere with either a crucifix or a cross. The faithful Protestants will have nothing to do with this because we do not worship or honour a material cross. We worship him who died upon a cross and rose again. And to introduce anything material to be the focus of the worshipper's attention savours of idolatry. Now, that Protestants have not always been true to their Protestant faith is not disputed. There was a cross in this church building years ago, behind me in the pulpit. Not during my time. But I know for years we tried to get rid of the mark left on the wall. And however many coats of paint were put on that background to the pulpit there, it never seemed to obliterate the sign of the cross. Thankfully, at last we succeeded. But there it was. And there are many Protestants not knowing their own faith and doctrine who have crosses on the top of their churches and crosses in their meeting places and sanctuaries today. And sometimes I'm called to preach at a place where in front of the lectern there stands an empty cross. It's Babylonish. The ninth fact is that in the worship of the Chaldeans or the Babylonians, statues played a great part. And you'll find a reference to this in the InterVarsity Press now, their dictionary of the Bible, which is a very good volume. And either under Babel or Babylon, I can't remember which, but there is reference to the fact that statues played a prominent part, and these statues were dressed and ornamented, particularly at festival times, and worshippers were set nearby them. Well, we don't have to go to the land of Babylon in Iraq to see idolatry like that today. Statues adorned in one way or another feature large in Roman Catholic worship, and processions take place with these statues being borne aloft. And the tenth fact, and the final one I'll mention here, is that many tablets from the ancient Babylon show figures carrying pouches or baskets of incense. And this incense was all part of the worship. And the fragrance and the clouds of incense were an integral part of the offering of that worship. Any Roman Catholic church will smell of incense, has a distinct smell. And in any full Roman Catholic service, there will be these pouches of incense, or this incense carried in some form or another, wafting its odour through the air. Its origin is ancient Babylon. And in case some bright person says, well, the Jews had that, you'll remember that they had it in a very different sense at the altar of incense, which was not far from the Ark of God. And it was they that entered the presence of God who offered up prayer for the people who lit the altar of incense as a symbol of prayer. But the carrying of these baskets or these vessels of incense around, that was Babylonian. Now, my friends, do you see why the Apostle John, when he is foretelling the rise of Romanism, the great anti-Christian church, should, when guided by the Holy Spirit of God, liken it to Babylon? When John had the vision revealed to him, it says he wondered. The meaning of the word is that he was shocked, he was amazed, bewildered even. Why? Well, he might have thought that the ancient religion of Babylon would be continued in the heathen world. But what astounded John the Apostle when he saw the vision, that this would be done in the name of Christianity, in a professing Christian church. Mystery Babylon. There's profundity here. There are depths here. It's not Babylonish religion continued, propagated, simply in the world, but it's Babylonian religion embraced and expressed by a so-called Christian church. No wonder the apostle says in Revelation 18:4, "Come out of her, my people, and be not partaker of her plagues." Now, in the second part of chapter 11, you have true religion. And it's an interesting fact, my friends, that two-thirds of this chapter deal with the godly line. This begins with the reference, "These are the generations." That's the fifth time that particular statement is made thus far in the book of Genesis. There'll be 10 times altogether. "These are the generations of Shem." And what the inspired writer Moses is going now to describe is this, that in spite of the existence of heathen religion, organized so subtly for the deception of many, God has his purpose concerning a true church, and he's going to work that purpose out. Now, there are some very significant comments that we can make here, and we must, of course, content ourselves with general comment, and I'm not going to be tempted to look at individual names here. The first thing which strikes me on reading this second part of the chapter, and I perhaps should have said a moment or two ago that the fact that two-thirds of the chapter deal with true religion and the preservation of the true church or the line through Abraham is an indication of the importance that God gives to his church. If this was a secular historian, I'm sure we would have learned a lot more about Nimrod and the kingdom of Babylon. But we learn most here about Shem and his descendants, because that is the line God is particularly concerned with. That's the line in which his church will be maintained. So let me make these comments by way of general observation. God proceeds with a purpose of mercy, no matter what is being done by men, no matter what is going on in the world. "These are the generations of Shem." Let's never doubt that, that the counsel of the Lord, that shall stand. And whatever rebels may do, whatever deception arises, whatever spiritual fornication exists amongst men who profess the worship of God, God has a purpose to which he keeps. And from age to age, from generation to generation, from year to year, he works out that purpose. Now that purpose is worked out, my friends, by way of sovereign election. Because it is an interesting thing when you read this latter part of chapter 11, how God's electing love comes to the fore. God chose one of Adam's sons, not Abel, not Cain, but Seth. God chose one of Noah's sons, not Ham, not Japheth, but Shem. And later, as we shall see here, God chose one of Terah's sons in verse 26. Not Nahor, not Haran, but Abraham. God is fulfilling a purpose, and God does make choice of men. And by reason of that choice, he provides for himself a church. Now the church has to be separated, called out, if you like, from the world. And this church represented in the line or family of Shem was separated, first of all, by the language confusion, when the peoples generally were scattered, as we read earlier in the chapter. And then, secondly, by a providence, because we read of Terah, that Terah went out of the Ur of the Chaldees, verse 31, took Abraham his son. They went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees. And what it was that caused Terah to migrate in this way, we cannot really tell. But we can safely say it was a providential act to separate them from the idolatrous Babylonians, Ur of Babylonia. And then, of course, as we find in chapter 12, God called Abraham, Terah's son, and called him to go into the land of Canaan, where he would bless him. You see, God's purpose here is being fulfilled. It's being fulfilled by a sovereign election, and it's being fulfilled by God making a people to be different, to be distinct. That is the way God proceeds with his church. And then we observe that these names of which we read here, they are links in the chain of God's church. It is the chosen line. It's the line from which Eber will come, the father of the Hebrews. And ultimately, it's the line through which blessing will come to the world. So God continues his church. Now, we don't know much about these generations. We read of Selah. We read of Peleg. We read of Reuel, and so on. They're names otherwise unknown to us. But sure it is, my friends, that in these names and in these persons was preserved the knowledge of the true God and the true knowledge of God, the worship of the true God and the true worship of God. God preserves his name. He does it through people. Now, the fact that we're not given any further information about these names is for a reason, because Moses, the inspired penman, is hastening on to Abraham. Because Abraham is the one who received the promise. And Terah lived 70 years and he begat Abraham, verse 26. So is this just a genealogy? Just a list of descendants of Shem? Or is it more than this? Is it the preservation of a people to whom was entrusted the knowledge of true religion? And is it the preservation of a people through whom one day Jesus Christ would come? The genealogy of Matthew chapter 1 traces the descent, the ancestors of Christ back to Abraham. The genealogy in Luke chapter 3, in verses 34 and 36, 236, recalls the very names with which we are familiar in Genesis 11. Abraham, which was the son of Terah, which was the son of Nahor, which was the son of Sarach, which was the son of Rahagh, which was the son of Phelek, which was the son of Heber, which was the son of Shelah, which was the son of Canaan, which was the son of Arphaxad, which was the son of Shem, which was the son of Noah, which was the son of Lamech, which was the son of Methuselah, which was the son of Enoch, which was the son of Jared, which was the son of Melchiel, which was the son of Canaan, which was the son of Enos, which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of God. That is why two-thirds of the chapter are devoted to this genealogy. Because through this line will not only come Abraham, the father of the Jews, but through this line will come Abraham's famous seed, in whom all of the families of the earth will be blessed. So all the time that the devil is agitating false religion, God is promoting true religion. So as I draw towards a close, what applications are there for us here? I think the very space and emphasis given to this line, which would become Israel, of which Christ should be born, of whom the church would be raised, and we part of that church, shows that the people of God in any age are the object of God's special affection. I have loved them, God says, with an everlasting love. The second thing we may learn from this is that the promises of God center upon his people. The family of Shem were not numbered. The members of that family were not numbered by, amongst the great ones. There's no one equal to Nimrod amongst them as a mighty one in the earth. And yet, these poor, despised people, they are the inheritors of the promise. And it's a blessed thing to be part of the church and to know that though you'll never be a millionaire and though you'll never have a vast estate, you have the love of God and the promises of God are your possession. A third truth from this latter part of the chapter is that there is a special providence over the church. Shem begat Arphaxad, Arphaxad begat Shelah, Shelah begat Eber, and so on. The chain doesn't break because the providence of God is encompassing this people. Oh, we have his love, like the members of Shem's family. We have the promises, all for our good and benefit. And we have a providence that watches over us in every age. And you may say to me, well, why is that? How does it come to pass? And the answer to that would be twofold. One is that the visible church is the seat of God's glory. These are the people who know him. These are the people who serve him. These are the people who worship him. And God is concerned for his own glory. And therefore, he will look after his church in this world. And the second answer to that question is that God will particularly concern himself with the visible church because Its members are as many witnesses to the world around. Ye are my witnesses, saith the Lord. And God won't leave himself without witness. So he's with the godly remnant. And he defends the godly remnant. The fifth truth, my friends, is that deliverance is afforded to the church even when she is in a low state. I'm sure the reason why Tyre, under the providence of God, began to come out of the Ur of the Chaldees or the Ur of the Babylonians was because there was great danger that the knowledge of God would be completely destroyed and that the people would be assimilated into the idolatrous practices of that day. And God delivered them. And in the history of God's church, there are times when the church is low and in a desperately feeble state, and we wonder what its future will be, and God has his own way in providence and in grace of restoring the church and preserving the church. The strength of Israel is his name. And sixthly, there will always be a continuance of the church in this world. The line continues through all these characters, Reu and Serug and Nahor and Tyre and Abraham. We need never fear for the church. Many of us have great disquiet at the present time on the state of the church, but we must never let our disquiet become the evidence of unbelief. Because this chapter shows us that God is greater than we are. And God will see that his church goes on and on and on. He says in the prophets, though I make a full end of other nations, yet will I not make a full end of thee. Jesus said, you remember, I will build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And the last truth I would bring to you by way of application is this, that God holds out a future glory for his people. Now he did for these descendants of Shem. There was to be a glory that Eber was to come of this line, who would give his name to the Hebrews, and Abraham would come of this line, to whom the great messianic prophecy would be given, and the messianic promise would be bestowed. Christ would come of this line. Salvation would come of this line. For salvation is of the Jews. And ultimately we would come of this line. There was a glory reserved for the church, even in this period. And here we are, thousands of years later, in the visible church, and there's a glory that is reserved for us. Glorious things of thee are spoken, Zion, city of our God. And what is the glory? The glory of the church is that despite all the fury of demonic power, the gospel shall be preached in all of the world, and God's elect will be gathered from the four winds of heaven. That's a glorious thing. The glory reserved for the church is that we are to see blessing yet on a universal scale. A vast company from Israel shall be grafting again. And what shall their engrafting be, says Paul to the Romans in Romans 11, but for the Gentile world, life from the dead. And when great numbers of Jews are converted to Christ, there will be revival in the Gentile world, and the knowledge of God shall fill the earth. Glory! And when the gospel has been preached, and when the times of blessing and the latter day glory has come, what then? The return of the king. And what then? The judgment of evil. And what then? The everlasting blessedness of heaven. Glory, glory, future glory for the church of God. There's a start place in this chapter. You either belong to the first part of it or the second part of it. You either follow the religion of the world and engage in ecumenical enterprise and be drawn into the fold of the Roman Church and come under the offices of the Supreme Pontiff, or you follow true religion with the despised remnant of God's people who hold fast the word of God and are faithful to him, come what may. I tell you, my friends, as I trust a faithful Protestant, that I would rather be in the second part of chapter 11 than in the first. I'd rather be in Jerusalem than in Babylon. And I would rather know the truth than Roman falsehood. We take heart. Satan is active, promoting latter-day Babylonianism. But God is active, promoting the pure religion of heaven. And let us end with the obvious. God is going to win.